I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI, Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1...
The opinions and views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or anyone.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine, California. I'm Nathan Callahan, and this is Weekly Signals. We're here today with Claudia Shamba, the host of KUCI's Ask a Leader, every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10. April is School Library Month and a time for us to celebrate, share, and educate others about the importance and impact of school librarians and libraries. Earlier this month, the Newport Beach Library Board made a decision to move a contested children's book from the children's section to the teen section in First Appeals Review. Melissa, previously published as George until April 2022, is a children's novel about a young transgender girl written by American author Alex Gino. The novel tells the story of Melissa, a fourth grade girl who is struggling to be herself to the rest of the world. The rest of the world sees Melissa as George, a boy. Melissa uses the class play Charlotte's Web to show her mom that she is a girl by switching roles with her best friend and playing the part of Charlotte. Now, under a new policy at the Newport Beach Library created in January, patrons of the library who have requested a review of materials can now appeal library staff decisions to the 5-member trustee board. Officials have said the library has seen an increase in requests to review materials. There are 6 more books pending appeal to the board. Prior to the appeals in September, Melissa has been checked out 60 times. By the time of the board hearing, which was earlier this month, April 15th, the book was checked out 98 times. The American Library Association defines young adults where the book was moved to as individuals between 12 and 18 years of age. For Melissa, the intended reader is 8 to 12 years old, so it was intended for children younger than what it has been now moved to. At the meeting, several people, including trustees, took issue with life-changing and medical aspects of the book being presented to younger children. Chase Reef, a trustee, said, "It concerns me that hormone therapy is presented to 3rd and 6th graders."
That hormone therapy presented to 6th graders, pushing back on that is, snip snip is the language that's in Melissa to that transitioning. So he may be writing a little bit hard the dogma that was presented to him at the forum or in the emails. Snip snip does not go that as far as he might pretend.
That's crazy. Yeah, that he would say that then. Does that make sense even? So apparently he hasn't read the book. A parent at the meeting said that a library should be a safe space free of anything children can stumble on that robs them of their innocence. That's a pretty loaded statement right there. I don't understand, first of all, how they stumble on it. I guess I understand that. And just exactly how long do you want them to keep this idea of innocence? And what is the value of innocence other than just a lack of something, really? I think that's what these people are referring to, is not knowing, having kind of a childlike look at the world, which I know that's a Christian concept, but it's also can be defined as naivete.
So that innocence, it's so abstract. We can understand there in terms of a conservative sensibility that innocence is a wish that they can capture and keep something that would be an unwieldy, curious kind of messy dynamic that is inevitable with coming of age. So coming of age is a long continuum from the earliest times when a child might discover the jets in a jacuzzi, if it hits a certain part of their body, it feels pretty good. And they didn't go to a library. There's all kinds of curiosities and queries and confusion going on at early dates we'll never be able to have access to. That innocence is so abstract, so undetectable, so all-encompassing in what that wish is on that board member's part and the others that join him in that conservative thinking.
And all the more reason to ban jacuzzis.
Well, that's a funny thing about banning jacuzzi, but I'm just explaining that there are discoveries that young people make at any point in their young lives. And so what innocence is just a wish to keep that genie in the bottle and the cork on tight.
Just like you said, it's an ongoing process. And in a lot of ways, I think we keep losing our innocence until we die.
Yes, that's true.
There are certain things about life that we're always shocked to discover, certain things that we thought we'd never see in our lives that we see, even, you know, on our deathbed. And in that, we lose our innocence for our whole lives. So I don't understand. I understand being a parent, of course.
Right.
I understand how you want to protect your child completely. But then when they do start to lose their innocence, that's when being a parent really starts. In a lot of ways, the serious business of being a parent. Before then, it's a matter of keeping them warm and fed and
them thriving.
Yeah, keeping them thriving. But once they start losing what these people call losing their innocence, what I guess we would call eating the apple or getting some knowledge, there are many different ways to look at things, and that you have to guide them through this maze somewhat as a parent. I think these people who would complain about losing their children's innocence are not really looking realistically at what is being presented to them in the world. They're not looking right at reality.
I think it's a challenge to their time and attention and energy too. This board member is an entrepreneur in a very expansive enterprise. And when people are multitasking as professionals, as parents, as community members, to have that challenge of your child's curiosity and exploration, if you can put one of those little challenges on hold, then you could keep it together, the tall order that you're trying to manage.
Yep. Well, some praise the book for being a lifesaver for children who might be going through a similar experience and a way to teach empathy to children. We should be searching for books that extend our sympathies to others, one person said at the meeting. There would be fewer suicides if they had more support, a woman said, adding that she is an emergency room physician who recently saw a 7-year-old child who had tried to kill herself. I imagine that referring to a gender-related issue. The children.
Correct. She had quite the testimony, and she didn't even have her white coat. I was there at that meeting. I wasn't there for all the comments. 24 supporting the librarian, 12 opposing the librarian's handling of the selections. But I did see the ER doc, and she was not wearing a white coat. She was very, very civilian comporting, but that should have been a public health cry for attention to providing all kinds of materials that validate what any young reader might need. Like you said, that one book on the shelf isn't saying, come look at me. There's all these books on the shelf.
As far as I know, it's never been featured there. The only featured time for that book has been at this meeting trying to ban the book. But we'll get into that later. A narrow majority of trustees supported moving Melissa to the library's teen section. I don't believe Melissa is pornographic, Trustee Paul Watkins, the board's chairman, said. I think the material in Melissa is a mature level, and I come down on relocation in the teen section. Trustee Lauren Kramer, who voted to keep the book in the children's section, said the facility is a public library. I don't have to agree with the content, she said. If I hear a lot of people want to read it, I have to make room for those I disagree with. In other words, she has to make room for Melissa. And she's not saying, I don't think she meant to say that she disagreed with it, only that she is, as a trustee there, is listening to the public and responding to what they need.
And her position, rendering her decision, was laced with references to freedom.
How did you read that?
That was her card she was flashing as, I'm a freedom-loving Newport Beach white female, and I get the freedom refrains that people are talking about in other situations. And on this one, this is what freedom looks like, freedom of anything on the shelf.
In a review and discussion of another book, Prince and Knight, the board voted 5-0 to keep it in the children's section. It's a less controversial book, Watkins, the board chair, said. It's sweet with an innocent theme, and it's a picture book. Prince and Knight tells the story of a young prince who falls in love with a knight after the two work together to battle a dragon threatening the kingdom. At the conclusion of the book, the two wed. It's funny how it switches there. You know, it's a 5-0 vote in favor of that. I wonder what this board 20 years ago, I wonder what their vote would have been then, or 30 years ago. I would assume they wouldn't have liked the prince and knight getting married, but what do I know?
Oh, I think the constant reference to it as just a sweet book, and I think it was a bit more of an objectively understood take. It's younger, and I think everybody's heard. I heard it when my younger of my two, when she was just registering her endearment with another brownie, with another classmate, and she said, I want to get married with her. It was just her way of expressing affection. That's not a gender fluid thing. It's an expression is all, not a commitment to a gender identity at all.
Sometimes I wonder, too, if you put pictures in a book, it makes people feel more at ease.
Oh, yeah. That's why I think they said it's sweet. They're referring to those, the pictorial part.
Exactly. So I guess I'm saying if Melissa had cute pictures, the vote might have been 4-1. The novel has received positive feedback from sources like the New York Times and National Public Radio for its inclusion of transgender experiences. However, the book has remained controversial to some parents and teachers, leading it to be listed on the American Library Association's top 10 most challenged book list every year since 2016, a year after its publication. Topping the list in 2018, 2019, and 2020. So it's an all-star of the challenged book circuit. Common reasons for challenging the book include its sexual references. I think they mean gender references.
Well, that was a point raised in the public comments is, biology is not sex. Anatomy is not sex. But for some, biology is sex. So that's a distinction that is in the eyes of the beholder as far as that public comment form and other forms are concerned.
Yeah, so common reasons for challenging the book include sexual references, which it sounds like aren't there, and conflict with traditional family structure. Now, I get that, with some saying schools and libraries should not put books in a child's hands that require discussion. I always thought that's the whole reason you put a book in a child's hands. I always encouraged my daughter to read on her own, but if she wanted to discuss anything, I looked forward to it, even at a very young age. Am I missing something there?
No, and that's getting back to what I was talking earlier about bandwidth of the civic leaders. That challenge of a child's curiosity to a parent takes some bandwidth.
Yeah.
Where is their mind? What is the appropriate answer? How do I feel about it? And if there's already conflict spinning that parent's head, then it's even a bigger bandwidth exercise.
And so the only thing they can think of is to challenge whatever it is, challenge the book.
Or set it all aside. Just remove it.
Alex Gino wrote the novel because it was a book they wanted to read, meaning that's Gino's pronoun. growing up. It's the book that they wanted to read growing up. Gino also wanted to write it because they noticed a lack of transgender middle grade literature aimed for third grade to seventh grade, and they hoped the book would help transgender children feel less alone. They wanted to fill this need and teach children about these issues. The novel simultaneously is meant to teach non-transgender children to be tolerant of trans people and show children who are trans that there are other people like them going through similar experiences, which is kind of what you hope books will be about, taking you into different worlds and showing you what it is about them that makes them unique.
And that's what I thought was the role for these kinds of books. That's validation for one reader, and it's developing compassion for other readers.
One of the major edits to Gino's work was the title. The original title was Girl George, a reference to Boy George, but Scholastic changed it to George during the editing process. Before the commercial release, Scholastic sent out over 10,000 copies to teachers in the United States, which received mixed but largely positive feedback. The teachers and librarians who opposed the novel argued that children are too young to be discussing these issues. However, the positive feedback convinced Scholastic, the publisher, to increase the first printing order from 35,000 to 50,000. It's a nice jump.
Yeah.
Translated copies can be found in English, Spanish, French, Chinese, Danish, Dutch, German, Italian, Japanese, Portuguese, Swedish, and Vietnamese. Gino and Scholastic changed the title of the novel from George to Melissa, saying they shouldn't have titled it with a name that the main character does not like or want to use for herself. Now, what's interesting is over the 10 years or so that it's been challenged, the book was challenged for a number of reasons. 2016 and 17, it was challenged because of the sexuality was not appropriate at elementary levels. In 2018, the book was challenged because it was believed to encourage children to clear browser history and change their bodies using hormones was another reason the book was challenged. It was encouraging children to change their bodies using hormones. Now, I've read a lot of children's books that talk about football. And I don't look at that as necessarily encouraging children to get concussions. I know that's a whole different encouragement there.
That's an interesting way to put it. Right. Yeah. Or careers. You can read about all kinds of careers.
Yeah.
That's not grooming you to only be a white collar worker.
Exactly. I'm not suggesting that being a football player is the same as being transgender by any means, but to say that you don't want a book because it talks about changing their body using hormones as if that's exactly what they're going to run out and do. In 2019, the piece was challenged for its LGBT plus content, use of sexual references, again, which aren't really there, and for conflicting traditional values, family structures, which we mentioned. In 2020, it was challenged for not reflecting the values of our community.
There's the movement opening up right there, 2020. It's picking up. It's a COVID disinfo template on wheels.
I just assume it's pretty much majority born-again Christian community.
Well, it could be other, not just born-again, could be a Catholic orthodoxy, or it could be other religious orthodox Jews, Islamicists.
Exactly. It's a fundamentalist challenge. What was it like at the meeting? Were those who would challenge the book because it contested their traditional family structure? Were they all grouped together?
There was that cue. There were those references there. And you could sort of see where they're getting that from. The micro-targeting, the news that they consume, and that those templates were liberally deployed.
Overall, according to the American Library Association, over 4,200 works in school and public libraries in the U.S. were targeted in 2023, a jump from the old record of 2,600 in 2022. So that's a almost double jump there, at least a third more. Restrictions in some states have increased so much that librarians and administrators fear crippling lawsuits, hefty fines, and even imprisonment if they provide books that others regard as inappropriate. Already this year, lawmakers in more than 15 states have introduced bills to impose harsh penalties on libraries or librarians. Now, thank God we live in California, but it's the rest of the country is outright banning books like this.
You can see the long game here, Nathan. Running this huge tab for a public entity to defend the way they do business, it's like public education defending the way it's doing business. This financial drain is a long game to end these public goods.
So you think this is part of taking down the public school system?
Well, they're parallel activities. The pattern detection meter is going, you know, it's broken. It's way in the high emergency zone. We can see that in how the Orange County Board of Education is running these applications, appealing denials of applications for charter schools that don't look right, that the county superintendent does not approve, but the board appeals those denials of those charter schools. So all of these resources are trying to undo the public service in the public schools.
Before 1999, many challenges had to do with profanity and violence that critics considered inappropriate for children. And then we had the Harry Potter years. Between 2000 and 2009, the Harry Potter series was frequently challenged because of its witchcraft and wizardry, probably coming from the same place, I would assume, from the fundamentalists. Now the books most frequently challenged either have to do with LGBTQ topics or characters, sex, abortion, teen pregnancy, or puberty, or books that have to do with race and racism. A controversy surrounding Melissa involved the Wichita, Kansas public school system and its decision to ban the book from its district libraries in 2017. The justification used for this banning was that the book included, again, sexual references and language considered to be inappropriate for children. The district supervisor of library media at the time, Gail Becker, obstructed district librarians' efforts to include the book in their collection by withholding funds intended to purchase the book. This is a supervisor of the library media. In response to this challenge, Alex Gino, the author of Melissa, organized a Twitter campaign intended to raise money to purchase enough copies of the book so that each of the district's 57 elementary and K-8 school libraries could have one. This has been going on quite a time for Melissa and for Alex Gino, this challenge. And in other places in the country, they literally banned the book.
Well, look at 2017. What was happening in 2017? We had a very unorthodox occupant of the White House who was saying the quiet thing out loud, and that was unleashed. 2017 yep. was going for broke.
Well, he's going for broke now.
Super broke. So I want to also interject what this campaign effectively distracts from is all schools around the country are codifying protocols for dealing with an active shooter.
Yeah, that's a great
and
point.
We know that these drills are traumatizing. So if the book banning movement can just distract everybody enough, there won't be an honest conversation about there's a prevalence of gun ownership. And at the end of this pipeline of gun distribution, manufacturing distribution, at the end of that pipeline are people that are being shot. And a lot of those mass shootings are at schools. So this campaign to ban books takes the conversation away from this pervasive trauma, whether it's from the rehearsal of the active shooter or the actual perpetration of these murders.
Do you think this is intentional at all?
How conscious is it? I think it's conscious for some.
I think the point is really great, and I think it is a distraction. I would go for it's just an unintended distraction. I don't know if they really would plan something like this.
Effectively, it's distracting. It was a point raised at the Newport Beach Public Library.
What did they say?
Discussion 2 Mondays ago. And there were a few public comments that the bigger concern should be about active shooters on campus versus what kind of book is on the shelf at the library.
Hello, everybody. My name is Henry Rollins, and you are listening to KUCI Irvine. Hold on to that dial for dear life.
This is Weekly Signals. We're joined today by Claudia Shambaugh, the host of KUCI's Ask a Leader, every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Here's an idea. In a letter to the editor, someone had written in, this is regarding Melissa, simply ban the students who fear the books from going into our libraries. So just get rid of the students. Let their parents supply them at home with the specific limited reading materials that are acceptable within their narrow life views. So if the child can't take it, keep them out of the library. If the parent doesn't think their kid can handle the content of the library, well, they're free to not participate in organized sports, and they're free to not go into the library. That way, these fundamentalists can happily control their children's minds and lives, but not those of everyone else's kids. Sure, those poor offspring who are sentenced to living in the solitary confinement of the controlled human mind might one day sneak onto the internet and reject their parents' mind control, but that's the risk when each person is born with a free and curious soul. I just thought that was an interesting comment. This is tongue-in-cheek, but nevertheless, there is the point that maybe the problem is not with the books. It's not with the education. It's not with learning what other people are feeling in their lives. It's your problem. It's the problem of people who are restricting their children's education.
When you said earlier that California, thank goodness we don't have to deal with that here, like what other states are trying to codify, but I am not happy for the constituents in those red states that are being deprived of a range of selections. It's not good for that state. It's not good nationally. So you're saying on the household level, I'm zooming back to up above statewide, nationwide, and I think there are public downsides to restricting those materials.
What I'm saying that this letter to the editor said is if the parents really want to restrict their children's education, then so be it. And you're saying you don't approve of that?
Well, that genie is going to come out of the bottle, and there may be, there could be all kinds of blowback when eventually that person, maybe in different ways, that resentment or oppositional behavior comes up, and it's just a lost opportunity for that individual. I think it's very complicated. Enabling that restricted, we know all kinds of incels and others that were limited in their earlier years. And I think if we stepped out of this puritanical culture of the USA, and we went to other countries that are so matter of fact about this material at really early ages, we would see how silly we looked at those other educational systems.
We'd be embarrassed for ourselves.
Yeah, well, I am anyway.
In a 2019 article in the Journal of Children's Literature, author and literary scholars Jill Herman Wilmarth and Caitlin Ryan argued that Melissa's focus on a white transgender character prevents the novel from accurately encapsulating the struggles of transgender people who are marginalized in more ways than just their gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people who think the book hasn't gone far enough, I suppose.
Yeah.
They also pointed out that Melissa expresses her identity as a girl in very traditionally feminine ways, such as wearing dresses and makeup, thereby shutting people who do not strictly fit into gender binary out of the novel's representation of transgender identity.
So there's where another book on the shelf can talk about another take and more fluid, non-conforming kind of a storyline. So it just means more books need to get on those library shelves.
Exactly. These people who spent their time writing this review should just get on with it and write a book, if that's the way they feel. And meanwhile, publishers, writers, and progressive organizations across the children's book industry aren't letting these book bans hold them back. Instead, they're turning the bans into a rallying cry to publish even more diverse characters and points of view. Over the last 5 years, there has been a steady increase in books by and about transgender that have made it out into the publishing world. I think we're just watching this backlash right now, which I just would really like to get through this particular one. There's too much backlash going on about too many things that people haven't acclimated to. We were just talking about people not being educated enough. Children being kept at home out of a library. I think we're seeing a lot of that right now. what we need are more children going into libraries and more parents who have the capacity to raise children.
Well, maybe this is the state of American parenthood. They're exhausted, they're overcommitted, and they are now vulnerable to some of these perverse arguments that are a wedge between the parent and public goods out there, you know, creating this crisis. American parents live very fragmented lives. They don't have enough support, and so they're just trying to hold it together. And this is one way they think with controlling the literary choices that they can hold it together just a little bit longer. They're buying time with that control. I'm sympathetic to those overwrought parents, and we all have gone in and out of those phases. I'm no longer in that phase. But this reach into every household with these messages that this is a crisis is what's on the bookshelf in the library, that micro-targeting is just getting better and better. And so your hope that we can get out of this backlash pretty darn soon, I'm concerned it's getting pretty embedded in the access to keep spewing that in the next manufactured movement, the manufactured crisis. I don't know what that will be to get ahead of that one.
The American Library Association has a library bill of rights. One of the rights is that a person's right to use the library should not be denied or abridged because of origin, age, background, or views. The first right is books and other library resources should be provided for the interest, information, and enlightenment of all people of the community the library serves. Material should not be excluded because of origin, background, or views of those contributing to their creation.
An acknowledgement that they are a public good. That's what public is all about.
When you say all people of the community, that means all people of the community. It doesn't mean that one portion of the community should designate itself as restricting others. And I think that's what's going on here.
Right on. And I think we can look at the activity once those books are getting all that attention. And I know you know this is true, Nathan. Once they are given that attention, that's the best endorsement for a young person to go and check that book out. And then the library has to add more of those selections.
Yeah, so
or the book dealer.
Yeah, the censorship of anything generally makes it more popular.
Everyone knows that. So maybe
yeah,
that's...
well, apparently some people don't. Those who spent their time organizing the protest of these books are helping promote these books. And like the author even said, there was something lacking and they filled a void.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's more voids out there.
The good news is that according to the Washington Post, half the challenge books returned to the schools. I guess that's good news and bad news, not the good news. Almost half of the books challenged at schools are returned to shelves, but titles with LGBTQ characters, themes, and stories are most likely to be banned right now. School officials sent 49% of challenged titles back to shelves. The next most common outcome in 17% of challenges was for a book to be placed under some form of restriction, which is exactly what happened at the Newport Library.
Well, I'd like to take that up, too. I have on background, I understand that with those next challenge meetings, that apparently there's an understanding that the board majority, at least, if not all of them, but the board majority will let all those six books up for consideration be placed where they originally are placed. The challenges will not be successful. We know that. But for all of you institution watchers, the trustee board chair, Mr. Watkins, is going to term out June of this year. And there is this Newport Foundation, which is sort of the kingmaker of Newport civic leaders. And the replacement for Mr. Watkins will likely be perhaps a little more dogmatic. One might sort of brace for that. So the composition of the Newport Beach Library Board of Trustees is something to continue to watch, Newport Beach listeners. And also my background source says, though, that even if we're concerned about this precedent that was set April 15th with moving the Melissa book out of the kiddie section into the young adult section, Newport Beach does not have the citizens board that Huntington Beach has built to intervene in some of these policy decisions. So Newport Beach is not quite going the way of Huntington Beach, but I think it will require some attention of Newport residents to be aware of that seismic plate moving under their feet.
Yeah. In February, the Huntington Beach City Council voted down an item seeking transparency in children's books restrictions. And the Conservative Council majority passed Resolution 2023-41 last October on a 4-3 vote. That was the book restrictions. The resolution seeks to stop children's access to books and materials that contain any content of sexual nature. Again, they have to get their terminology
a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. Any. And that's why it's opaque in their policy deliberations, because they would like no light shed on whether biology and sex are being conflated in the content they're trying to remove.
If they're going to take on these challenges and form these rules and regulations, then they have to get their language down. I want to know what they're talking about here. It's so vague and so incorrect as far as I can tell. Any content of sexual nature, I think they really have to get their language together. If they're going to pass laws, they have to learn how to define their laws.
But that's not their point, though, Nathan.
Yeah.
It's not about the logic of it. It's only about the dogma of that appealing to the base with that disposition. It's all emotion. It's got nothing to do with a factual, logical kind of approach.
They're not qualified to be on a city council, then, when you're a city council member. You should be concerned about laws and community assets and deficits and learn how to speak the language of legislation.
Well, that's a whole huge topic. And that their job is about ample servings of dogma there at Huntington Beach, the majority on the council.
That's a shame.
That's their job, and that's it. And we all have to be vigilant, and that's a lot of work for people to keep track of their local officials and be active on down ballot kinds of activity. So, but that's a whole other topic for 1 year later shows.
Yep. Now you were talking about their yet to be formed parental advisory board of up to 21 people to review and approve future books before they're brought into the library. Is that what you were referring to earlier on?
Is that the term? Okay. Yeah. But that's Newport Beach claims that they are not going to be going the trend of Huntington Beach because they don't have that kind of instrument right now.
Yeah, I'd be careful if I were them. They might be facing that.
Well, I think there were some concerns on that at the April 15th meeting that this was a precedent. It was a line that was crossed. I called it. At the meeting, it was a yarn that's starting to get pulled from the sweater.
I just thought this was an interesting factoid here. On February 7th of this year, librarians at the Central Library in Huntington Beach started moving books from the children's section to a restricted ex-adult section on the fourth floor. So we're talking about a children's book getting moved to the X-rated section.
There's too much irony there.
Yeah, yeah. It's the council itself who are the children in this. Our guest today has been Claudia Shamba, host of Ask a Leader every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m., You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine, California, on the web at kuci.org. I'm Nathan Callahan, and this is Weekly Signals.
conception to the Mexican border, this is the SoCal Bite. I'm Nathan Callahan. On today's menu, the patron saint of obscenity. Evil to him who evil thinks. The other day, my cousin Wayne, who, by his own admission, is a very religious man, told me I'd go to hell because of the language I use. He was half serious and half right. I do use language that could get me in trouble. Let me explain. The podcast broadcast you're listening to is designated as explicit on iTunes. One definition for the word explicit is precisely and clearly expressed. Explicit also means leaving little to the imagination, especially as far as iTunes is concerned, regarding sex. The only explicit thing I do on air, besides being precise and clear, is use the words f**k and s**t, as in, what the f**k, and holy s**t, neither of which regards sex. In June 2004, during a charged-up debate on the Senate floor about Halliburton's role in Iraq, a role which, could be said, was obscene, Vice President Dick Cheney told Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, go f*** yourself. As if by an act of God, Cheney's explicit language occurred on the same day the Defense of Decency Act, or as we like to call it, the Don't Ever Say F*** on Air law, was passed in the Senate. The bill allowed the Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, then headed by Colin Powell's son, Michael, to increase the amount they could fine broadcasters for explicit language. The fine for on-air explicitness rose from $27,500 tenfold to $275,000. Then Congress, not to be outdone decently, nearly doubled that fine to $500,000 per f***ing infraction. Thus, the Bush administration created an unrealistic increase in the shock value of the word f**k. Broadcasters call this the f**k bubble. Now that you have some explicit background, let me explain how on-air decency works. Here at KUCI-FM, if I say we should lock and load for the next election on air, that's decent by FCC standards. It may mean that you should prepare for gunplay during the next election. But apparently, it's not explicit about that. If you're into metaphors, locking and loading leaves room for your imagination. It may, metaphorically speaking, be about locking your door and loading your Facebook page. As long as we don't say, we should lock and load for the next f***ing election, on air, nothing is indecent or explicit. To the FCC, a word's explicitness has nothing to do with its context. Let's use the word f**k as an example. There's nothing explicit in my saying, I'd like to f**k with your head. If I call you a f**k, I'm not being explicit about what aspect of you is f**ked up. I can also f**k around thoughtlessly, which means without explicitness. In fact, I can be so inexplicit that I can f**k up. It seems that decency and explicitness go hand in hand when it comes to expletives. Yet the FCC has not been explicit about its consistency on this. Until April 29, 1987, I could talk about angel-headed hipsters who let themselves be f***ed in the ass by saintly motorcyclists and screamed with joy. The sodomized angel-headed hipsters are, of course, from Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl. On October 3, 1957, it was ruled that the reading of Howl was free speech. That decision, which has never been overturned, was handed down by a famously conservative judge, Clayton W. Horn, in the People of the State of California versus Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was Ginsberg's publisher. Horn said that if written material is disgusting, revolting, or filthy, the antithesis of pleasurable sexual desires is born, and the writing, therefore, cannot be obscene. Horn also used the famous quote, "Oni soi qui mal pense," evil to him who evil thinks. But the Federal Communications Commission really doesn't give a f*** anymore about that ruling. In other words, since 1987, as far as the word f*** goes, obscenity is in the mind of the FCC. Which brings me back to my cousin Wayne. There are those of us who, when told that we'll go to hell for saying f***, believe there's nothing obscene about words. But does that belief protect us from Wayne and the FCC? I think not. That's why we need an agent in heaven, a patron saint of obscenity. After all, there are patron saints for advertisers, actresses, broken bones, and broom makers, patron saints for hernias, sheep, and syphilis, even patron saints for whales and roller skating. But there is no patron saint for obscenity, someone who has the ear of God and can explain the difference between words and foul, repulsive, detestable acts, like Halliburton in Iraq. Now, you might think we won't be able to find a saint who speaks our language, but I disagree. Saints have to put up with sinners, our impatience, our bad manners, our wars, and especially our judgmental nature. If anyone has a reason to say, "What the f***?" it's a saint. For more SoCal Byte audio essays, visit SoCalByte.com. That's SoCalByte.com. The opinions and views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or Daniel Dennett, one of the most widely read and debated American philosophers whose prolific works explored consciousness, free will, religion, and evolutionary biology, and who I had the great honor and great good time studying under here at UCI in 1970. Here's to you, Dennett. I'm Nathan Callahan, and this was Weekly Signals.